It is.
along
It's
with
the
that.
in-depth class, but we're going to do a really like around the world in 80 days overview of the entire Buddhist path.
Yeah,
So it's all right.
absolutely.
So hold on to your hats, everyone. It is these Wednesdays, they're in-depth classes. And this is the last unit of a three-year course. So many, many units, but it kind of covers a little bit of all of the previous units as well. So it's an okay one to start on. I think that's perfectly fine. As with all of the in-depth courses, you just relax, treat it like a bit of an SBS movie, you know. You're not quite sure what's going on. It's kind of interesting, and it kind of becomes apparent at the end.
Are
But
there subtitles?
yeah, there are subtitles over on the screen over here. So there you go. So quite a few of you have done this course before and are joyfully repeating it for how many times now, Ben?
Five.
Five times. I rejoice. I rejoice. That's great. And some of you, your first time to doing this course, but have been coming along to Discovering Buddhism. Some of you, first time here at the center. This is the only one of Discovering Buddhism that I actually lead, and I kind of got a bit of a different style from Eddie, so it'll take a moment to readjust. For our the course materials, there are online, there are mind maps, there are the FPMT notes. I'll give you a hint about which ones to read each week. There's the PowerPoint slides, and there's also in our bargain box a whole stack of books on Tantra. The material of this course comes from a couple of those books on Tantra, but also from the what's called the basic program, which is the in-depth program, Buddhist studies program up at Chenrezig Institute, full-time study program. So I did the lower tantras and the highest yoga tantra courses up there. They're the only ones that I've done on that advanced level. So that's how come I'm leading this course. So the lower tantras one was 6 weeks. The highest yoga tantra one was 8 weeks. I don't think I've ever studied so hard in my entire life. It was 24/7 without stopping. And it was really amazing. And so from that, then I kind of put together this course along with the hints from the FPMT notes. And a couple of years later, another Introduction to Tantra book came out that was in exactly the same order as I'd put it together. So I'm like, whoa, I'm on the right track. And when I was doing those courses, I really thought it was a make or break moment. It was because it was such in-depth study, and I thought either it's going to blow apart all my preconceptions and I'm just going to go, no, I don't get it. Or it's going to be really helpful. And I was quite happy for whatever the result was going to be. And so it was mind-bogglingly inspiring and explained so many things. And I really went from just kind of hope and belief and inspiration to, for the first time, a real sense of confidence that this is possible and now I know why and we can do it. So I hope to be able to share some of that with you as well. The other thing, of course, with Tantra, it's a little tricky because tantric practice is supposed to be secret. That's one of the names of Tantra, is that it's secret. But of course, now that Buddhism has come to the West and Tantra has come to the West, there's a whole lot that's in the public domain. So many of the lamas, even though they have vows of secrecy when they're a lineage holder of the practice, when they give commentaries, when they give weekend courses, like Geshe Sultran just gave a weekend course on Tantra, you're not supposed to actually talk about it, but there it is all on Google. And a whole lot of it is not necessarily correct. So it's much better to actually clear up misinformation. But nevertheless, is like walking a tightrope. So, my question to all of you, just have a little think. What if, just think, what would it be if you yourself could become a Buddha in just 3 years? So, it's a nice proposition, isn't it? Because if we keep going along the Bodhisattva path, it takes a long time. It doesn't mean that you can't do everything as you're going, but it takes, on average, three countless great eons to become enlightened on the Bodhisattva path, which is an unimaginably long amount of time. So what if it only took a few lifetimes to become a Buddha? Or what if it only took a few years or even less? So how is that possible? It's the rocket ship path, the tantric path. And the lightning vehicle, as it's called, is really swift. But just like a rocket ship, you've got to have a whole lot of safety measures in there for it to turn out well. I do remember actually Venerable Gyatso said, even though it does take three countless great eons to become a Buddha on the Bodhisattva path, it's not like we're at the beginning of those great eons, folks. We're really up towards then because we've come across the path or we've been able to meet the Bodhisattva vows, do the practices. So we're actually, you know, we're not right at the beginning, we're on the way. with the Tantra path, so when we're going to talk this introduction to Tantra to give you an overview so you can make an informed decision about Tantra, those of you who have already taken an initiation, hopefully this course will fill in some crucial gaps because you can do all the study in the world, but then once you kind of embark on a practice, then all those questions come back again and they have a different context. So it'll be able to strengthen your confidence, especially getting all the workings and the reasonings behind everything, so that we're not practicing superstitiously. So not just practicing hoping for the best or with a sense of just blind faith or belief, but really understanding the meaning, the workings, and having a natural confidence about it. For those of you who have not yet had an initiation, there are some initiations coming up this year. So now the pressure's on to really figure out, am I ready? What's the criteria and what's it all about? Because the tantric path isn't to be taken lightly. It can actually go wrong if it's misunderstood. And you just have to Google and you'll find some very entertaining instances of that. But also you can have a lot of ambivalence about it too. So it's better not to have ambivalence because time is ticking, isn't it? We don't know when we're going to die. How are we going to make this decision? So what we're going to have a look at in the course, I think we've got 8 weeks. So this week we're going to look at what's unique about Tantra, the unique characteristics, and we'll have just an overview of the greater and lesser vehicles, so where it all fits into the Buddhist path. Next week we'll have a look at what's the foundation, and the foundation being the three principal aspects of the path, so what makes it Buddhist, but also what our responsibilities are as a student, and that comes first. From our side, what do we need to do? And then how to recognize a qualified teacher. Because not all teachers are qualified and not all teachers are qualified in everything. So we have to really know what we're looking for and appreciate what is there. Then the three gates to enter Tantra. So this is the one to figure out, are we ready or not? So the three gates being taking refuge, entering the Bodhisattva path and the Tantric path. And so each of these have different commitments, different vows, different things you have to do, different things you have to avoid. We're going to look at the four classes of Tantra. So some of you might have heard the term Highest Yoga Tantra, or even more confusingly, HYT. And you're like, what the heck is that? So there are different levels or classes of Tantra, and they have different methods of utilizing all of our energy on the path. So how to work out what each level is and how we can tell if we're ready for each level. We're going to look at what are called the four Buddha bodies. So a Buddha, a fully enlightened being, is a lot more than just a person, just an enlightened person, but is the whole Dharmakaya mind and Rupakaya rainbow body, as well as the person. And if we want to become a Buddha, we have to accomplish these four Buddha bodies as well. Then we'll have two classes, one on the path of Action Tantra, which is a lower tantra, and one on the path of Highest Yoga Tantra. So this will give you an idea of what the differences are, the different approach of lower tantras and Highest Yoga Tantra. So the initiations that are coming up this year, one will be a lower tantra permission to practice with Geshe Zopa, the Vajrasattva one. And then there's the really big Highest Yoga Tantra initiations at Chenrezig Institute in September. And there's also Kala Chakra initiation in Bendigo. So you'll be able to figure out the differences between them with that. And then lastly, the key to success. And the key to success with tantric practice is guru devotion. I mean, the key to success with any of our Buddhist path is guru devotion, but especially in tantra. And for a long time, I had no idea why. I was like, convince me. How come? But it's to do with so that we are protected, so that we don't get sidetracked, so that we have quick results, so that our heart is open and we have confidence. So guru devotion really is the key, but we can't enter into that foolhardy. We have to know what we're doing. If we don't have guru devotion, it's such a precarious path that things can end up badly, not just neutral. You don't just fall off the wagon, but you probably fall off the wagon and bump on down the hill into the ditch way down there. So we really want to be careful when it's needed. So eight classes. Told you around the world in eight classes. So the main books that will be referencing. So this one, Big Fat Book, Secret of the Vajra World, is very readable and quite inspiring. There's the one, the blue one on the right there, Introduction to Tantra by Lama Geshe. That's the main one that I refer to. And there's a whole lot of copies of it in the bargain box. I've got one of the first publishings of it when they had them all color-coded. And this one actually comes from my dead mum who started this center, Inta. She gave it to me even before when my name was spelt differently. Dear Miffy, may this be your traveling companion over the years. So I must have been, I don't know, it was when our phone numbers were only seven numbers. Oh. It was that long ago.
And landline and plugged into the
wall. That's right. And a dialy thing. So yeah. The other one by Bokar Rinpoche, any books by him, they're really expensive, they're out of print, and they're amazing. They're so clear. In just a few words, he'll really sum a whole lot of things up. And the one that's just called Tantra with the kind of pinkish maroon cover from the English Geshe Tashi Sering, that's the one that has the really similar trajectory of this course. And also really useful, really clear. So that's the overview. Let's do a couple of prayers to set our motivation. So I thought we can just do them a bit differently from what we're used to and sing them in the Tibetan because we don't often get a chance to do this. Adjusting your posture, making sure that your spine is relatively straight. Imagine a fine thread of light running from the base of your spine up through your body, coming out the crown of your head. Feel the weight of your body supported from your crown. Let your posture naturally extend. Become aligned, your spine become aligned. Tuck the chin in, relax the jaw, put a slight smile on your lips. Let your eyes be just lightly closed. Release any tension from the neck and the shoulders. Bring to mind all the sentient beings who are suffering so horribly, and we here ourselves have this incredible window of opportunity. Bring to mind Shakyamuni Buddha and all the enlightened beings in the space in front, our perfect valid objects of refuge. And we can generate refuge in bodhicitta, going for refuge with an altruistic intention. Sangye charan sovye chana lai chan chu padu tani kyab su chi ta ki chen yi kyepe sonang ki chola panche sangye tropa shu sangye charan sovye chana lai chan chu padu tani kyab su chi Dagi chenye kepe sonam gi Trola penche sangye tropa shoy Sangye cheran sogye chanagla Chanchui padui dani kyap sui chi Dagi chenye kepe sonam gi Trola penche sangye tropa shoy The seven limb prayer. Busun go pe gane chazalor na sham yi troi chatri malubu to amene sai ti to an tam che shai ke pai ke wai nam lai che And offering a short mandala.
So she poor him, Joyce met on Tom Rira Blinji, Nitek Empati, Sangye Shindu, Mite.
Okay, so today looking at the greater and lesser vehicles, the difference between sutra and tantra, and then the six names of tantra. So these are all from mind map number one. But basically, I'm going to give it a go to go around the overview of the Buddhist vehicles in 10 minutes or less. So Buddhism, incredibly vast, changed its form and approach in each country that it came to, and as it has in the West, without losing the essence, without without necessarily corrupting the truth, but changing the approach according to what's appropriate for each culture. And so with what's called the lesser vehicle, the Hinayana path, which His Holiness the Dalai Lama calls very diplomatically the Pali tradition, much nicer to say that. It's been called the lesser vehicle or the Hinayana, not because it's lesser in importance, but lesser in scope, sometimes known as like the more modest vehicle, because the goal, the main goal is our own liberation. That's what we're striving for, freedom, peace. So it's like being on your bike. There's just one person on there. You're wobbling along. It's okay. You can fall off. You get back on again. It's all right. And, of course, the main method is the view, the Buddhist view, wisdom realizing emptiness. That's the view, but the main method is renunciation. So that's the main practice, to renounce all of the ephemeral pleasures of samsara. And so that's the main thing that we concentrate on, is getting rid of desire, dismantling desire. And so the main practitioners on this vehicle are the hearers and solitary realizers. So if you came to Geshe's Opus teachings, you might have heard those two terms. So the hearers are those beings who take teachings and meditate on them. The solitary realizers are those who've taken teachings in a past life, are born into this life, have perfect recall of everything, and go and practice and meditate alone. So there are actual practitioners like this. I remember quite a few years ago now, there was in the news a meditating boy in India. So he was sitting underneath a tree in meditative equipoise for months without moving. And it was really quite extraordinary. There's all these photos and everything, but then more and more people started coming and disturbing. So he went deeper into the forest. And then even more people started coming, so they put a barrier up. And so the army started protecting him. And then it just got too crazy. And then one day he was just gone, disappeared further, deeper into the forest. But he was sitting there, and slowly his hair just grew longer and longer. Young 16-year-old boy, solitary realizer. So the hearers and solitary realizers are the main practitioners of that vehicle. Then the Mahayana, the great vehicle, great because the goal is a universal goal. So the goal is not just one's own liberation from the grind of samsara, but it's to the main goal is to be able to help everybody else out of samsara. And the way to do that isn't by being an ordinary person, is it? Because it's really hard. The only way to effectively do that is to become a Buddha, a fully awakened Buddha. So it's a really huge view, attitude, a universal attitude. And so I've depicted that as like on a bus. You take everyone with you. Everyone comes along with you. And so the result are Mahayana arahats or foe destroyers. The main practices are the practices of the six perfections, the paramitas, because that's the Mahayana approach, or the mind training teachings. Of course, the view, wisdom realizing emptiness, the same across all of Buddhism, that's kind of what makes it Buddhist. Renunciation goes without saying. But also the main driving force is bodhicitta, that altruistic intention. So within Mahayana, there's Mahayana Sutra and there's Mahayana Tantra. And so the Mahayana Sutra is, I mean, they're not separate paths. One builds on top of the other. In fact, all of them, you know, build on top of the other. It's not like you ditch one path and get the next one. So, for instance, along the way to being a surgeon, everyone has to learn anatomy. And whether you're a nurse, whether you're a physician's helper, whether you're a doctor, whether you're a surgeon, everyone learns anatomy. Once you go on to become a doctor or specialize in something, it's not like you ditch anatomy. It's always there. So you just add on more and become more specialized. So within Mahayana Sutra, the main, what's called object of abandonment, or the main thing that we're trying to get rid of, is all the afflictions and all of their seeds. In the Mahayana Tantra vehicle, we're trying to get rid of all the afflictions, all of their seeds, and what are called all the stains, all the imprints. meaning ordinary appearances, the ordinary view. And like I said before, the Mahayana Tantric vehicle, it is the rocket ship. Now, where did I put it? So I have a little thing to read to you from Lama Yeshe, who I had the great fortune to meet when I was a child, who I absolutely loved like a mother and father, more than I loved my own mother and father, who I just called Interim Barry. But Lama Yeshe, he was my main man. And I did go to a course once when I was a child and tried to take notes, and I think I took two lines worth and I gave up. It was too much. But anyway, so this is what Lama Yeshe says. According to the Buddhist teachings, no matter how confused or deluded we may be at the moment, the underlying and essential nature of our being is clear and pure. In the same way that clouds can temporarily obscure but cannot damage the light-giving power of the sun, so too the temporary afflictions of body and mind, our confusion, anxiety, and the suffering they cause, can temporarily obscure but cannot destroy or even touch the fundamentally clear nature of our consciousness. Dwelling deep within our heart and within the hearts of all beings without exception is an inexhaustible source of love and wisdom. And the ultimate purpose of all spiritual practices, whether they're called Buddhist or not, is to uncover and make contact with this essentially pure nature. So according to Mahayana Sutra, the path to fulfillment is gradual. It's a process of cleansing our mind of all of its faults and limitations and developing in their place beneficial attitudes such as love and wisdom. This path consists of creating specific causes, behaving ethically, developing our powers of concentration, training a meditative insight for the future attainment of full awakening. And because of this emphasis on creating causes for a future result, the gradual approach of Mahayana Sutra is sometimes known as the causal vehicle to enlightenment. Don't think it's the casual vehicle, by the way. Easy. Someone once said to me, oh, it's really cool, Mahayana Sutra, because it's the casual vehicle. So compared to this, though, gradual sutra approach, Tantra is a far speedier path to enlightenment. Although tantric practitioners do not neglect creating the same causes as the followers of sutra, they take the future result of full spiritual evolution as the very starting point of their path. To put this in other words, the tantric yogi or yogini learns to think, speak, and act now as if he or she were already a fully enlightened Buddha. Because this powerful approach brings the future result of full awakening into the present moment of spiritual practice, Tantra is sometimes called the resultant vehicle to enlightenment. So, Sutra and Tantra, just to get a little closer in with that, Mahayana Sutra, the Bodhicitta method, the emptiness view. So you have those two, they work together. And there's no danger in this vehicle. You can't really go wrong. You can't go wrong with bodhicitta. You can't go wrong with great compassion, great equanimity, great love, all of those things. The object of abandonment, afflictions, and their seeds. The result, you become a Mahayana foe destroyer of the delusions. And the it's called the causal vehicle because you put in place antidotes to the problem. So you have a problem and you counter it with an antidote. So it's step-by-step process. So gradually your faults are whittled away and all of your qualities are developed. The Tantra is completely different because it's renunciation, it's bodhicitta, the view of emptiness, but the main method is called deity yoga, yoga meaning practice. So the wisdom realize emptiness, with deity Yama. And the tantric path is called the path that utilizes desire. So that means we use the energy of samsara. So instead of being overwhelmed by the energy of samsara and all the desirous attitudes and all the emotions going crazy, we use that energy. But it's crazy energy. So it takes some skill. So we need a basis of the three principal aspects of the path to make it a positive, virtuous thing. We achieve the four complete results of a Buddha, the four Buddha bodies. And it's the only practice that actually achieves the four Buddha bodies, the full result of a Buddha. And instead of being step by step, you take the future result into the present. So it's a bit like fake it till you make it. Or I have heard with people that have gone to jobs and job interviews that you dress for the job that you want, isn't it? You don't just go in your tracky dacks because that's more honest. You dress for the part and you embody the part and then you become it. So it's taking that whole approach. So you get your chenrezig on, or you get your tara on, or you get your manjushri on, and you just do it and practice it till it becomes second nature, till actually you can reveal that manjushri or tara or chenrezig nature within that's already there. A lot like kids pretending to be superheroes. That was fun, wasn't it? It wasn't like, oh, no, today I have to pretend to be a superhero. What a drag. I think I procrastinated about it a bit. It was like, I can't wait to be this fantastic thing, to embody this fantastic thing. So we identify with being enlightened beings, but to make sure that that isn't a dangerous thing, because it can go incredibly wrong, we could just have delusions of grandeur, like, there are checks and balances. We have initiations and commitments. So before I go on, dare I ask, anything to clarify, any questions, comments? How are we going? How are we going so far? Kate, have we come across any bumps in the road yet? No?
Can I ask a little one?
Yep.
With the books you put up, the titles of all of them were Tantra, 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 but one of them is Tara. So
does
Tara feature really
She does. Significantly? Tara, the feminine divide. So actually, Bokar Rinpoche has written one on Tara and also one on Chenrezig. But yeah, Tara does feature. In fact, a teacher who brought Buddhism to Tibet relied mostly on Tara. And same with Lama Tsongkhapa, hugely features. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
it is, but so it's more a method. It's like method acting. So it's not necessarily accurate, but it's a valid method. Yeah, and eventually it becomes, from a Buddha's point, from the point of view of a Buddha, it is valid. But from our convoluted point of view, it's just method acting to start with. But the benefit of it is that it's so incredibly fast and effective. So instead of just a little bit by little bit, it's like total immersion. Yeah. Yeah. Good question. So in the Mahayana Sutra, we know how a fully enlightened being would act because we're practicing the perfections, the six perfections. So not just ordinary generosity, but the perfection of generosity that is coming from altruistic point of view, and that has this understanding of interdependence within it, and has a whole goal of practicing generosity to become a Buddha. So there's a whole lot of information that we can all learn and practice with that, so we know what it's like. And in the further class, when we talk about the foundation of Tantra, the three principal aspects of the path, that's how we can, that's like our checklist to tell. So then how does a Buddha act depends on what sentient beings need. So that's why there's so many manifestations of the Buddhas, why there's Chenrezig Buddha of compassion, and why there's Hayagriva, who's also a Buddha of compassion but looks incredibly wrathful, all these different manifestations to help sentient beings. Also, how do we know is by, as practitioners, figuring out what are our responsibilities as a student and what the characteristics of a really good teacher are, at the minimum. So that's another good checklist as well. Yep.
An online question. Is there any difference in the path or result as to which deity we attempt to embody?
With the actual deities themselves, no. And actually, which ones we practice, when Lama Zopa Rinpoche was alive, he would be able to tell which deity we have the strongest, best karma with that we would practice that would be really successful for us.
Does that then mean that that's part of an initiation?
Yeah, it's always part of initiation, yep. But, you know, who doesn't need wisdom and who doesn't need compassion? It's not like we're going to go, oh, no, I don't need that one. We need all of them. We need to be a completely well-rounded Buddha with all of the skills to be able to help sentient beings. Okay, so what is Tantra? Now, here's a little bit from Bokar Rinpoche, and that's the question, what is Tantra? And he says the word Tantra means continuity. In a literal sense, the term refers to the nature of the mind beyond any psychological elaboration in all its purity. This notion of continuity underscores that the nature of the mind is not something new to obtain, something that couldn't exist now and would come into existence, for instance, at the end of the practice. Continuity is present at the base, what we are now, at the path, and at the result. Whether it is veiled or revealed, it is always there, without discontinuity, as the union of emptiness and clarity. So I told you, it's pretty mind-blowing. You could read just one paragraph in this book and sit with it for quite a long time. So what we've got is continuity of what? That indestructible purity of our mind. And it is unbroken, whether we're in a coma, whether we're awake, whether we're asleep, that continuity is there. And it is that most subtle mind that, completely untarnished, pure, indestructible, that we just have to be able to reveal. So there's a continuous state from us being sleepwalkers through life, going along and then becoming awakened. It's not that we magically turn into something else. So then we have the Tantra, the texts, the textual Tantra, which is all the practice manuals, the instructions, the legitimate source, something that we can trace back to the time of the Buddha. In art world terms, it's the provenance. We can trace the provenance. But the texts aren't it. That's the textual thing. What Tantra is the meaning Tantra. And so that's the living tradition, the realizations of the text that are living within the minds of practitioners. So in other words, it's that process of going from the basis oneself along the path with the result. So Tantra is actually the experience, the practice and the experience. How do we know if we have the meaning? We're not just parroting the text. If we, as we go along, become naturally more kind, if our friends say, hey, you're a better person nowadays, if we become naturally kinder, and if we become naturally more peaceful. It's kind of a no-brainer. If that's not happening, we're missing something in the puzzle. And the practices utilizing desire. So that means that the tantric practices are not naturally virtuous. They're not naturally good. They're kind of neutral. We have to make them virtuous. We have to give them a purpose and a direction. Okay, so this is from Reginald Ray, this one, Secret of Vajra World. What stands in the way of this goal of spiritual maturation? Only our mistaken concepts of ourselves, our rigid and defensive ego structures. What is an example of where the Buddha nature is at work? In fact, the Buddha nature operates in all people all of the time. It's said that the universal experience of suffering is a manifestation of the Buddha nature. It's the message that our egoic versions of reality are inadequate and cannot bring about lasting satisfaction or comfort. How does the Buddha nature move us forward? Through revealing to us the shabbiness and hollowness of the ego that we're trying to maintain. Through showing us the inadequacy of the ways in which we try to allay pain and control our lives. So I really like that because it just turns suffering completely on its head, because it's suffering is there because it's showing we are out of step with our own potential, our own Buddha nature. As we shall see, as we go on in the course, in Tantra, one visualizes oneself as a fully enlightened Buddha. This visualization gives imaginative representation to our own Buddha nature within, which is otherwise inaccessible. So that might go to some way to answer your question, Ben. So we start with this imaginative representation, and that connects us to what we're disconnected from, that Buddha nature within. Through enacting the tantric liturgies, one's own sense of being a separate egoic self gradually dissolves and is replaced by the Buddha nature. This is not a new identity and has nothing in common with the old identity that's being released. Rather, it represents the ability to rest in the open, empty, cognizant nature that is at the very core of our being. In Tantra, one thus trains to live in terms of the Buddha nature, not thinking of oneself as a solid and discrete entity, but to act without the need for the deliberate self-referential strategies of the self-conscious I. Anyway, this guy is a bit of a roller coaster, but I like reading them. So before we go on to what is known as the six names of Tantra or the unique characteristics of Tantra, do you have any questions about this, the base, the path, the result? Yeah, so that's the shorthand way of saying it, utilizing the practices utilizing desire. It's like a code or a shorthand. But what the actual longhand is, the practices that utilize the energy of desire, the practices that utilize the energy of anger. So anger is an energy. desire is where we overestimate the value of something. So we project qualities onto it that aren't there. And because it's a mistaken view of something, then it leads to disaster. So we overestimate the value the potential of our loved one, and we expect so much from them. And then when they don't measure up, then we're devastated. We take refuge in our relationships. Under the definition of desire, so we need food to live, right? But if you have a desire for food where you overestimate its value, that's where, like, you've just got a sweet tooth craving, you just absolutely positively got to have that apple crumble. And that's different because it's a distorted experience and your mind is not under control. You're just hungry. Yeah. You know, and if you can be hungry without freaking out, that's a really good skill. Because if our well-being depends on having that meal and we don't get that meal, we're in big trouble. So I remember hearing about, you know, you've got to fast if you go and have a test in hospital. And I'm like, I come from a bit of an erratic background, a starving artist. I lose track of time. I don't necessarily eat whenever I'm like, oh, yeah, whatever. You just don't eat for however many hours. And they say, but don't you just freak out that you can't have any food for 4 hours? I'm like, wow. Hadn't occurred to me, that kind of thing. Yeah, so it's not utilizing anger, it's utilizing the energy of anger. And you've got to be really careful what you're angry about, because again, anger is a blame game. So you've got to make sure, what are you blaming, the person or the delusions? You have to love them whilst you're doing it. Yeah, I know, social justice, but it's also how we get a lot of violence. And this is why social justice warriors burn out, because it's not just that the energy of anger is also mixed with anger, with blame, and with being highly invested in a result. And so then burnout comes, and then you become bitter, and then you become disappointed, and all of that catastrophe. It's really hard to utilize it. It's really hard to just keep it as fighting against injustice. It's really hard to keep it pure without just turning into fighting against others, us and them. So that's why the practices utilizing any of those emotions, it's dicey. We've got to be really careful and really sincere, absolutely honest, and have no ego in there at all, or we will get into trouble. We'll go, this hurts me, then it hurts you, whack. You know, and that's just, that's not acceptable. Yeah. So we will go more into that as we go through the course. We can't learn everything tonight, folks, as much as I'd like to. Okay, so now let's have a look at what are called the six names of Tantra. And so this is how I remember it with whatever they're called. So the six names: secret, mantra, resultant, vajra, methods, and the canon of the Vijayadhara. So the way I remember it is secret, Mr. Vajra, and his method canon. So, you know, he's a spy, he's got his dark glasses on and his trench coat, and he's got a vajra in his hand, and he's on his method canon. It's probably the only one of these that I can ever remember. So we'll come back to see if you can remember it this way at the end of the class. But for these six names of Tantra, so secret, and this is also in mind map number two. So the reason it's secret isn't because it's just the chosen people or something, you know, exclusive like that. It's secret so as to not cause harm. From who? From what's called an unsuitable vessel, meaning someone without an initiation. And to give you an example, it's like, for instance, the plans to build an atom bomb or a gun, they're supposed to be secret. But then they get on the internet and now suddenly it's a dangerous situation. So it's not that they're secret as a power trip. They're secret so that they don't get into the wrong hands. So the tantric path of utilizing all of our emotions on the path to become a Buddha, this speedy practice, was actually devised for lay people who had really busy lives, who couldn't go and become ordained and live in a monastery. It was like, what can I do that's like thought transformation in my life that can get me enlightened really fast while I have all of these other responsibilities that you can practice in your daily life and no one need ever know. So I think it started with the Kala Chakra tantric system. There have been many famous tantric practitioners that only when they die you find out. Everyone just thought they were a housewife or just a cleaner. a nighttime cleaner emptying the rubbish bins, and it turns out that they're this incredible tantric practitioner that you know, lineage holder, and just really humble, you know, nice people. The other reason why it's secret is so that it doesn't harm our practice, because if we go around big noting ourselves, it attracts obstacles. It attracts jealousy. So even when things are going well for us, many people will get envious about that. So in a way, you know, sometimes they say the more virtuous you are, the more obstacles you attract because of that kind of just knee-jerk envy. So you keep it under your hat. As an artist, I also know that too, that when you're doing an artwork, when you're creating something, you just don't show anybody because you're too vulnerable. And also, if it is good, someone's going to hate it, and then that's going to ruin your confidence and tip you over. So you just keep it really quiet. You're supposed to keep it secret even if you lose your faith, even if you lose your religion, you still keep that vow of secrecy. But mostly it's to do with to not harm others. And especially, like, for instance, even just in a monastery or a Dharma center, we're supposed to have a huge picture of the Wheel of Life and the 12 links at the entrance. But can you imagine, here we are in Brisbane, and the first thing that people see is this devil holding a wheel of all these different realms. Like, it's going to, of hells, that's right, it's going to freak everybody out. So unless we can get some nice little speech bubbles that explain it all, which is a really excellent story, if we've got pictures of all the wrathful deities around, it's just going to give everyone the wrong impression. So we don't want to create obstacles like that. So that's the secrecy. Once you have an initiation, then you can do the practice, then you can read the commentaries, and you can find out all about it. So in this course, I'm just going to be able to talk about general things. All the things are in the public domain. Then the word mantra. Mantra means mind protection, protecting the mind. So for those of you who've done this course before, what are we protecting the mind from? Yes, that's right, Bev. Ordinary appearances from the ordinary view, ordinary appearances and ordinary conceptions, especially of oneself, who we are. When we have ordinary view, ordinary appearances and ordinary conceptions, then we act ordinary. Then we act just like, oh, well, everyone gets angry, everyone gets jealous, and so we just keep on going around. If we have the pure view of Tantra, where we view ourselves as a fully enlightened Buddha and everybody else as a fully enlightened Buddha, there's going to be no room for the afflictions to arise. We're not going to get frustrated or impatient. So we're naturally protected from a whole lot of delusions. So how we protect the mind in Tantra are, there's this particular term, it's through the non-dual yoga of profundity and clarity, is the actual translation. But what that means is through what's called divine pride and clear appearance. So divine pride, instead of just identifying with our low self-esteem and all of our problems, we identify with our Buddha nature as if we're already a Buddha, and we have a divine pride. So it's not egoistic pride, it's like ultimate self-respect. So that protects us from the ordinary conceptions, the limited conceptions. And then we have what's called clear appearance, where we are see ourselves as a deity and everyone else as a deity, and the environment as a pure land. And that protects us from the ordinary appearances that come in through our senses. So you know how what comes in through our senses we believe is real, even though even scientifically it's not real. but we still believe it's real because we're so dominated by our senses. So this is a way of working with that dominance and lessening it by having this pure view, clear appearance. So in Tantra, it's an affirming negation. You meditate on emptiness, but you have a positive appearance. So you protect all of your senses so that whatever you hear as the sound of the mantra. And whatever you environment that you're in, it's the environment of the pure land. And whatever, you know, whoever you see, they're Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So you replace ordinary with extraordinary. And then you're not going to have ordinary reactions. It's nice, huh? Well, even ordinary reactions, how we normally go, oh, no, instead of like, how interesting, how wonderful, how interesting. Non-dual yoga of profundity and clarity. So the profundity is the emptiness and the clarity, the clear appearance. And it's an affirming negation.
One lingo.
Oh, yeah. It's like learning to speak ye olde worldy English, you know. It's highly technical language. Okay, so the next two names. So resultant. Taking the future result now means that you practice the future result now. So you walk around as if you're already enlightened. You speak as if you're already enlightened. You act as if you're already enlightened. So, for instance, has anyone ever, say, been in the city and there's been the beggars or the money collectors on the corner? Okay, so what do you normally do when you see them?
Give them money.
Give them money. You're a good man, Gary. Hide, run, cross the road, avoid them, scowl. Okay, so there's a whole range of things. So just even in an ordinary view, like you can feel resentful, put upon, or you could just be good-hearted and be generous. So with that generosity, if you naturally have that generosity, it's good, but it's limited because it just lasts for as long as that act. And then it's done. Mm-hmm. And then maybe, you know, whatever money that you've given, then whatever benefit that does, it just lasts for as long as that benefit is. It might be invested somewhere, so it might last a little longer, a day. Maybe if it gets invested in housing, you know, it might last for as long as the house, but it's still limited. And most of the things that we do are limited like that. They have a very short lifespan, but usually it's just a few moments. But if we gave that money with a bodhicitta motivation, how long do you think that benefit would last for? If you do it with a mind of bodhicitta?
Until you reach enlightenment.
Until you reach enlightenment. That's right. So if you think, I am giving this money to you so that I can perfect the perfection of generosity, to become a fully enlightened Buddha, to be able to benefit all sentient beings. And then you do you slowly take it out of your pocket because and then you put it and then ka-ching, and then by me offering you this money, may you become, you know, free of samsara and suffering and achieve the enlightened state, and may I be the one to bring you there. Here's your 50 cents. So the well, yeah. Depends who it is. They might get a kick out of it, you know, like they might go, wow, they might go, I don't want your 50 cents. That's too complicated, too weird. Yeah. Oh, yes, that's right. Even there, that's right. Out of feeling guilted, yes, into so that ordinary generosity. Pressured into it, you might do it through pride, that what would other people think, oh, everyone else is, well, I will. Or generosity. But again, even if you are generous, what happens if they're really rude back to you? Then it's like, huh, why did I should have given it to the other bloke or whatever. So even with our generosity, it's very contingent on their response. Even in the best possible scenario with that ordinary generosity, it's still limited in its result. If it's with a bodhicitta motivation, then even if the money gets embezzled, it's still been a really beneficial action at the minimum for us that we are progressing along the bodhisattva path. And unless we destroy it with negativity, that merit will last until the goal being enlightenment. From a tantric point of view, you've got your generosity, your good-heartedness, you've got your bodhicitta motivation, but you've also got the pure view. So it's not an ordinary thing that's happening. It's you, the deity, say Chenrezig, with your one of your thousand arms, offering to Chenrezig there sitting on the blanket on the street, joyously making a divine offering, completely pure, uncontaminated, in the nature of emptiness. And it's like just the what's called the sport of bodhisattvas, the blissful play of the mind. Mm-hmm. So that's a completely different way of looking at things and of acting. And to kind of bring it back to earth a bit, the way that the lamas bring out the best in us, the way they relate to us, is because they're relating to us like that. They're not relating to us as problematic people. They're relating to us as potential Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, or indeed as a whole room of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And that's why they're so ready to laugh and they're so joyous and open-hearted just naturally, because that's their vision. It's different. They're not like, oh, my God, another bunch of these people again. No. All the time enthusiastic to share and to teach. So it comes from that pure view. So a whole different way to give money to beggars, and who knows what's bigger. And it's probably Manjushri there on the street anyway. So then the Vajra, the Vajra. So a Vajra means like a diamond thunderbolt. And what it means is indestructible, strong. And what is indestructible here is the indestructible reality of Buddha's body, speech, and mind at the most subtle energy level. So our Buddha nature, you can't break it. It's indestructible. So this is the way that we apply the antidotes with this thunderbolt lightning quick method. And then all the different methods. So I haven't seen this movie, but I wish I had, of all the different manifestations of types of, what's it called?
Inside Out.
Inside Out. Right. So there's your homework, folks. Utilizing all of the emotions that we have, if we're not driven by the worldly concerns, if we feel sad, we use sadness on the path. If we feel happy, we use happiness on the path. If we feel desire, we use desire for the benefit of others. If we feel angry or frustrated, we use it to benefit others. So none of it's to do with assuaging our own emotional state. It's using that energy. But that takes a lot of skill to be able to do that without going wrong. So it's like thought transformation psychology mixed with deity yoga. And if we do that, then instead of having to continuously counter our negative energies, you know, counter our desire or our anger, we counter the affliction part of it. And we use the energy. So I've heard like in martial arts, you have someone's coming at you, instead of just stopping them, you just use their momentum. And you can only do it if you yourself are really calm. So you don't harm them and you don't have a counter force. You just use the momentum of that for your own own goal. And our own goal is to be able to liberate all beings from their suffering. So it's not about us. The moment we start thinking it's about us, or danger signs already, it's got into the eight worldly concerns. So in terms of the actual practices, there are many meditations, and especially in the highest yoga tantra practices, they're highly technical meditations. So we've got to be able to focus and concentrate, and we have to be able to follow the instructions, because it's like using a chemistry set. If you got a chemistry set, I remember reading about Oliver Sacks. He got a chemistry set when he was 12 and he blew up the left side of the house. Yeah, because it's like, wow, wonder what happens when you put this and this in. And it's like, kaboom. And I mean, he really loved science and was even more excited about it after that. But it's like, when you use these methods, they work, whether you're ready for it or not. So you've got to be careful. Got to follow the instructions. They're systematic, they're scientific. It's not like some random experimental thing. Oh, it just feels right to do this or feel right to do that. No, that's just like mucking around with the chemistry set. And lastly, the canon of the Vijayadharas. And this is the really amazing thing. So there is a benefit of what's called a life Vijayadhara. So it's like a knowledge holder, a long life knowledge holder. And part of the tantric path is that you accomplish what are called the common accomplishments, which are things like being able to dispel obstacles. Clairvoyance is like a side effect, a good side effect, and you can expand your lifespan. So if you want to become a Buddha in one lifetime and there's not much time to go and you feel like you don't have time, part of the practices is to expand your lifespan so that you can complete the path. So white Tara practice in particular is to be able to do that, to extend your life, and a lot of the protector practices to remove obstacles so we don't have an untimely death or have obstacles that stop our progress. Clairvoyance, where you can see into the future or read other people's minds. So it's kind of like that you can see and know things without the barriers that we normally have. But clairvoyance is also about what's going on with people. I mean, to a degree, anyone who's really skilled, like a really skilled doctor, they just see someone. It's not like they'd say they have clairvoyance, but they know how to read the subtle signs. A sixth sense is where you can't quite put all the pieces together, but you see one of those pieces.
Yeah,
that's right. So many times the lamas, they can see the pieces that we're missing, and we're like trying to spell out, oh, they've got this problem. They're going, yeah. I get it. You just need to do this. So one of them, so they're all called ordinary accomplishments. Like we kind of go, oh, wow, you know, someone can see the future or someone can extend their life or remove obstacles, as if that's some, that's probably the most amazing thing that we hear about. But they're ordinary things. They're ordinary because they're accomplishments that are, what's the extraordinary accomplishment is enlightenment, is things leading to enlightenment, not just the worldly stuff. The other part of this, the canon of the Vijayadharas, is that you receive the blessings of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that you actually are cared for by them. So that means that you don't have to do it alone. You're not alone by yourself, like, oh, me little person here struggling to get enlightened in this big horrible samsara. It's like once you embark on the path, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are there to help you. Huh?
Cheerleading.
Cheerleading, that's right, that's right. They have your best interests at heart and they're always there to help you. And so what stops us is our ordinary view, being really concrete and inflexible and kind of inward kind of leaning. If we have a practice where we generate divine pride and clear appearance, that like clears the pathway for all that help to come. So things happen much easier, much quicker, much smoother, much more joyously. So some of you who've done this course before have heard this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway because it's one of the few times where I've really sincerely prayed, you know, like just prayed from the heart. And it's when Tara got me a taxi. And it's quite a few years ago now when we were still in the Newmarket Centre. This centre was in Newmarket. And I had to lead a course that started at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. And on the Friday night, my Buddhist friend Pearly, which she had a gig, so we went out to the gig. And it was fantastic. I would hardly ever go out. And so some of the people got a lift home, and I'm like, no, I'm going to stay to the end of the gig and see. Anyway, so the end of the gig, it's all time to go home. I went out. There's no taxis anywhere because unbeknownst to me, it's Halloween. There's like, there's no more buses left. There's no taxis anywhere. And there's hundreds of people out everywhere. And so I'm like, my whole focus was I've got to be able to get back home to be able to lead this course. And of course I had massively high heels and very inappropriate clothes. So somewhere lost in West End, no phone, no, I'm like, no, I think the bus is this way. So I'm wandering around in the dark, had to take my shoes off. So I'm barefoot. I hope I don't stand on anything, and just this way and that way. And there's houses and trees and bats and all sorts of stuff. And then I finally stumble across a main road and all the buses are finished. And on one end of the road, there's this huge long taxi queue and no taxis and like hundreds of drunken people all there waiting for a taxi. And up the other end of the road, on the other side, another huge long queue of everybody waiting for taxis, all rah, rah, rah. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm going to have to walk. I'm going to have to walk from West End to Newmarket. Oh, well, so be it. That's what we're going to do. Off I go. So I continue down the road. And I'm thinking, well, I'll probably make it home by like 8 o'clock in the morning. And so I'll be able to have a shower and have an extra coffee and I'll be right. It's okay, Miffy. And so then this taxi pulls up right in front of me in between these two huge long queues. And this lady's driving the taxi and someone's getting out of the taxi. And I'm like, this is Tara. So I thought, I'm going to act not like a drunk person. So I was just really quiet there. Are you free? And she's like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And so then the moment the person got out of the taxi and paid the – so I got into the taxi, thank you so very much. And then the people from that queue and the people from that queue are like, how very dare you get the last taxi on earth. Anyway, so I got in and shut the door and she just went zoom and took me home. And I think even gave me a discount or something on the taxi. And I am to this day, I'm sure that's Tara. She's just like, it's okay, Miffy, we'll get you home. So sometimes when everything's aligned like that, where I've just genuinely just prayed. Another time when we were looking for this building and we were every Monday we'd do the Diamond Cutter Sutra together, and this building came up and we put in a application for it and we didn't actually get it on the first go round, but it was at the same time that His Holiness the Dalai Lama was visiting Australia and teaching, and we're about to go down to Sydney like the very next day. And I can remember being in our gompa just praying to His Holiness and saying, you promised to help people when they asked that you were going to be there and you'd help them. You promised them now's the time to fulfill your promise and help us get this center, because if we don't, then it's like it's all over for Langley Thompson Center. And the very next day we got it. And I'm just like, yeah, you can. But it's so hard to actually have that really sincere kind of no bullshit kind of. But instead of like where we're so used to just things going wrong, it's a real hard slog push uphill and then more things go wrong. You know, that's what we're used to. But it's different. It's different on it when we have real refuge and when our heart is pure, then we have help. And we have help that you just wouldn't credit in any other way. And we have help even, you know, even in our dreams, even just the way our heart changes, we have help. It's not like we're alone. And I think that's really profound and something to remember. And the last thing, of course, is that part of the teaching, this basis for the canon of the Vijadharas, the long life Vijadharas or knowledge holders, is that we get to quickly complete the Bodhisattva path. So instead of three countless great eons, you can actually even become enlightened in just 14 lifetimes by just keeping the vows and commitments purely. 14 lifetimes. I mean, it's just inconceivable. Just by sticking with the program. Not only that, but here's this quote. Mr. Secret, Mr. Vardro and his method canon. The quote is that in one short lifetime of a being of the degenerate age, from the first initial practice of Tantra until the attainment of Buddhahood. So this means that we can become a Buddha in one lifetime, and not from having to start from a very young age at three or four. Like if you're going to become a great ballet dancer or piano player, you know, or a golfer or whatever, you've got to start young. But this can be from when we first encounter the tantric path, from when we first encounter Buddhism. Within, you know, being in a degenerate age, of which we are, from the first initial practice of Tantra until the attainment of Buddhahood, it can just be one short lifetime. So you don't even have to have grown up a Buddhist. You can meet Buddhism quite late in life. So I'll give you an example. So Inta, my mother, who started this center, she only met the Dharma when she was 50, when she came across Buddhism. So she had a background in psychology, World War II refugee, came from Latvia. So Latvia was, you know, under the thumb of the Nazis and then under the thumb of Stalin, and, you know, people ended up in camps in Siberia and all sorts of things, and Inta ended up in Australia. And so after lifelong searching, she came across Tibetan Buddhism. Actually, well, she started yoga, maybe she was 42. She came across Hinayana Buddhism, she was 44, went to various courses at Wiseman's Ferry with a great teacher called Prakantapalo. I think she came across Mahayana Buddhism when she was about 47 years old, and maybe had her first initiation when she was 50. So she went to the Diamond Valley course at before Chenrezig Institute existed, met Lama Yeshe and Lama Zo Rinpoche, maybe had her first initiation at the age of 50. And then I remember when she was about in her late 60s, she said, Rinpoche said, I should start doing what's called completion stage practices now. So it's kind of where you change the focus of your practices from what's called generation stage to completion stage. And I think that's because he could see that she was going to die fairly soon. So she died, she was 71. And then, Lama Zo Rinpoche said she had a really good death. His Holiness the Dalai Lama said she had a good death, because they just happened to be in the same hotel at the time when Inta died. So when we let Rinpoche know, then Rinpoche let His Holiness know. And so she died at home at Lungri Tungpa Center. There were quite a few people around her. And we let the body there for, you're supposed to leave the body until there's a sign that the consciousness had left. So it was about 2 or 3 days. And in that time of the 2 or 3 days, it was me and this other lady, Gail. We kept on hearing this amazing music just coming from, we could not figure out where. It was like, it was trumpets and cymbals and just this exquisite music, like a little bit like the higher Tibetan trumpets. And at first I just thought I was hearing things, but then I asked Gail and she's like, yeah, that music, where's that coming from? But it was the music of the Dakinis. It was the music of the Dakinis coming to get her. And then once the consciousness had left the body, was just a shell there, then everything changed. So it was amazing for me. I was like in my late 20s to witness something like this. And Inta, when she died of lung cancer, so she knew she was going to die. She kind of had time to prepare and to say goodbye to everybody. And she was really intensely curious to see what was going to happen. All the practices that she'd been doing about what happens in the death process, all the tantric practices that understand how to go through this process to meditate, to become enlightened. She wasn't frightened. She was just really curious. And so my job as a daughter was to just make sure that nobody else freaked out and that I could just help her do whatever she had to do to have a good death. And so it worked. It was good. And then I'm like, wow. So this is my first up close death that I've ever had anything to do with. Oh. It really gave me a lot of confidence. Yes. So the lightning vehicle is possible. And not only that, even if we can't become enlightened whilst we're a practitioner on the cushion, there's an amazing plan B, which is becoming enlightened in that state when we're dying, when the physical senses and everything have shut down, but the consciousness is still there, so there's no distractions. So that's where you can meditate and become enlightened, have realizations. And we can all aim for that. That's possible. So, last questions before we finish. So, a Vajra, you often see them, you know, like in the cartoons where you have a lightning bolt and it goes like that. So, the Vajras, how they're drawn, and also you might see there's a metal Vajra that we hold in puja, it represents like a lightning bolt. So, you think of it. There's a big difference from the representation of a lightning bolt to actually what lightning looks like. But that's what a Vajra is. It's a diamond thunderbolt. It's a lightning bolt. The Buddhist Vajra has all the four points, and the middle one, the five, they're all closed. The Hindu one, they're open. It's kind of different. We've also seen things like tridents, you know, like Zeus and whoever the ocean's guy is, they have tridents and things like that, but this is the five points together. And so what it represents is the purity of the mind, the fundamental diamond purity of the mind, unbreakable. And also the indivisibility of bliss and wisdom realizing emptiness. No, that's a different thing. The Hindu swastika thing is more like a, is it a long life thing? I'm not sure.
Buddhist.
Yeah, it's also in the Buddhist iconography too. But I don't know very much about that. But I'm pretty sure it must be related, actually. It could be. So up here, see on the throne here for His Holiness, how it's a double Vajra, it's that square, and it's the same as, if we go back down the bottom here, there's the four. So that's a double Vajra. Each of those triangle bits has four bits and one in the middle, five. And what they represent is like flames. They're light. They're like lightning bolts. And they're different colors because they represent different wisdoms. So I think the one, like the swastika, is like a, I'm not sure, but I think it's like a very stylized symbol of this Vajra, because the swastika is usually what you sit on, and so it's like a diamond seat. The seat is the indestructible purity of the mind. That's our foundation. So that's what we offer here to the guru, that the seat of the double Vajra. I mean, it's hanging that way, but actually what we're offering is as a seat, a throne. Okay, so in summary, we've covered a lot of ground tonight. The Buddhist paths, the lesser vehicle, they're not separate paths. They build on each other. The methods do vary, but not the view. The view, wisdom, realizing emptiness, that's what makes it Buddhist. So the lesser vehicle, the main practices that are focused on is renunciation. That's where we learn renunciation. You know, that's where they shine. The Mahayana Sutra, the main practices with bodhicitta, and that's where we learn bodhicitta. And then Mahayana Tantra, the main practices with deity yoga, and that's where we supercharge our practice because we can't wait one more second to become a Buddha because of the suffering sentient beings. The foundation is the three principal aspects of the path, which we're going to look at next. That's what makes Tantra virtuous. And the six names illustrate the real unique qualities of Tantra. It's an incredibly unique system. And the unique object of abandonment is another technical term, unique to Tantra, is to abandon ordinary appearances, the ordinary view, so the stains. In the Mahayana Sutra vehicle, you abandon the afflictions, you abandon the seeds, but you still have the mirage vision. You know it's a mirage, but it's still that ordinary vision. With the Tantric vehicle, you don't even have that. And so the reading, here's the reading. In the FPMT notes, page 34, the meaning of mantra, and page 37, Pavonka's advice. And then there's mind maps 1 and 2. And next week we're going to look at why we need the three principal aspects of the path, and then from our side as a student, and how to find a qualified teacher, or how to recognize a qualified teacher. So let's dedicate then. You can unpin your ears. Have you all taken a photo of the homework? So dedicate, may everything that we've talked about and contemplated and even got confused about, may it be seeds on our mental continuum to quickly lead us to enlightenment so that we can quickly liberate all sentient beings from suffering and bring them to enlightenment too. Kia ora te inu doda lama sa ge troi kune troi chi kyan ma lupai te Cham cho sem cho rin po che ma ke pa na ke kyo e chi ke wa nyang pa me pa ya ko ne kun tu pa wa sho For His Holiness's long life. Chi te kam te pe te ma lu pa ta le jo we And And then very excitingly for Rinpoche's return, so we just 2 days ago just had news that Lama Zorup Rinpoche, His Holiness has recognised that Lama Zorup Rinpoche has been reborn somewhere in Nepal. So Rinpoche has come back. It's 2 years almost to the day since Rinpoche passed away. So he's been reborn but has not yet been found. So now they have a search party, and so now we still have to manifest this karma, folks, and bring it together so that the reincarnation can be found and kept safe and brought up well and properly, and so it all turns out well so that we can welcome the reincarnation right back here into Lungri Tumpa Centre and into our lives and the lives of all beings. So for Rinpoche's swift return. Thank you so much, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Enjoy the homework. Thanks, online people.